Welcome to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm your host, Graham Richmond, and this special episode is part of our Admissions Director Q&A series. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Rupal Gadia, Managing Director of MBA Admissions and Alumni Marketing and Communications at Harvard Business School. Rupal joined HBS in 2023 after an accomplished career spanning brand management, management consulting, and global marketing leadership with roles at Campbell Soup Company, Booz & Company, Genpact, and SharkNinja. She earned her MBA from Harvard Business School in 2004, following a bachelor's degree in industrial engineering from Kettering University. Without further ado, let's bring Rupal onto the show here. Welcome, Rupal. It's great to have you today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I appreciate you making time. I know I gave a little bit of a bio on you, but if you would maybe just tell us a little bit about your background and maybe the path that led you into this role, because you kind of left industry to come back to Harvard in this role. And I'm just kind of curious to know what led you there.
Yeah, I was born to Indian parents. And so my parents gave me the choice to either go and be an engineer or be a doctor. And I figured engineering was a shorter school cycle time. And so I chose engineering. I worked for about a year in industrial engineering at Delphi, which was part of General Motors, and then decided to go get my MBA in order to pivot and change careers because I had my engineering baseline that my parents wanted, and now I could go do what I wanted to do. And when I was at HBS, I was torn between a career in marketing or a career in social enterprise. And so I was trying to decide what I wanted to do. I talked to my mentor, and she told me to go get some skills first so then I can actually apply it to a social enterprise or nonprofit in the future. Mm-hmm. And so I began my marketing path. So I worked at, as you mentioned, Sara Lee Campbell Soup, brand management. I went and did a stint in management consulting for a while at Booz & Company, came back into the kind of the consulting slash brand world and worked in the agency world for about a decade.
Oh, wow.
And then went to work for Genpact, which is a B2B company that is a spinoff of GE, running their brand and digital marketing teams. And then my last role was at SharkNinja. And when I was at SharkNinja, I was just thinking, I was thinking back to that person that I was 20 years ago and trying to figure out if I wanted to do social enterprise or marketing. And it just seemed like the perfect time, because I think when you're on a career trajectory, you're always kind of going to the next thing, and you don't take a step back and say, okay, what did I actually really want to do? What did Rupal 20 years want to do? Mm-hmm. And so when I saw the call from Jana, who's now my boss, calling for all alumni to apply for this head of admissions role, I threw my name in the hat. I didn't think there was a chance I would get it. And here I am. And I feel so lucky and so fortunate. And this is truly my dream job.
Yeah. And I know we connected briefly when you first had joined, and now you're, you know, a few years in. And so it's got to have been a real, I mean, it's just such a, it just seems like it's been a great experience. I know I've seen you out on the road doing events and everything. And I have to ask you though, like what drew you to this role? So I recognize HBS is quite unique in that, as long as I've known, that the executive director or the managing director of the admissions team has been an HBS graduate, right?
Yep.
And so so they put the call to them. But what drew you to this? I mean, other than you mentioned earlier, this desire to maybe be on the kind of social impact side, which education clearly has that role. What keeps you excited about this kind of work today even?
Yeah. I mean, I love the school. I love the school. When I went to the school, it's just, it was a hugely transformational experience for me in terms of not only just a career pivot, but actually finding my voice, finding my confidence, being able to speak in rooms. And so to give back to a school that had such an impact on me was exactly what I wanted to do. And then I'd say the admissions world, it's just, I get to surround myself by these up-and-coming leaders, these people who are going to make such a huge impact in the world every day. It's a dream job, right? Like, I get to learn about all these different industries, all these different things that people are working on a daily basis. And that's why I truly, when I say this is my dream job, it really is, because I'm just surrounded by these amazing, amazing people that are going to do amazing things in their lives.
Yeah. And that's been a recurring theme as we talk to admissions directors at some of your peer schools too. Everyone talks about, the energy that they get from seeing, as you just, you describe them as these kind of up and coming leaders. And I too remember when I was reading applications in admissions, you just learn about all these industries that you have no idea what they were. You know, it's such a great opportunity to kind of continually educate yourself and be inspired.
For sure.
So I guess with all that in mind, though, like what is a misconception that you think applicants tend to have about admissions officers or even the admissions process? Because I feel like here you are saying you love reading these files. It's you know, kind of energizing, and you get to see all these amazing people. But on the candidate side, I think there are a lot of nerves, and they kind of sometimes rush to conclusions about, you know, this process or the people, you know, who work in admissions.
Yeah, I'd say a misconception is that people think that they have to check every box, just be perfect at every single box, right? So get the best GMAT score, get the best grades, get the best recommendations, get the best everything. And what we're trying to see is, who are you as a person? Who are you, and what do we see as your potential? And what are you going to bring to the school, and what are you going to bring to the world post-school, right? And so I think it's not, we don't need everything to be perfect. We just need to know who you are. We need to know the real you. And so I think a lot of times candidates will focus on one part of the application. They'll focus on the essays, and they'll hone in until they get it exactly perfect. But I think this whole application process and all the things that we ask are just to piece together a puzzle of you. And nobody is perfect, right? Like, nobody's going to have everything exactly perfect. I used to joke with one of my classmates that's now a professor here. I'm like, if I actually apply to this program now, I don't even know if I would get in, right? And I remember the nerves of all the pieces that you have to make sure you get right. And I think the misconception is, we have an algorithm and we're going to push everything through an algorithm, and that's how we're going to select the class. And we're a really human process. We want to get to know who you are. We want to get to know everything there is about you. And then when you're invited to interview, we want to know even more, because we're intrigued by what you've written. So I think the misconception is that this is, you submit and we run a calculator and you get in, you get an interview or don't get an interview. But that is 100% not the case. We really are trying to get to know the whole human.
So along those lines, can you sort of reassure our listeners that when they apply, and I mean, I know this is true, but just for everyone's sake listening,
for sure,
that like their application gets read several times before a decision is rendered, that I know they're going to spend hours and hours preparing it, but you guys spend hours and hours reviewing these things. It's not at all a mathematical process, right? I mean, just because I feel like sometimes people really worry about that. They think it's like someone looks at the cover sheet and tosses it aside or something.
No, each application is at least read twice. Mm-hmm. At minimum. Mm-hmm. And then when you're invited to interview, you have your interviewer that like thoroughly reads your application in the greatest detail. And if you ask any of the people that we've interviewed, we go all the way down into every detail that you've written about, right? And that's mainly because we know, like, we have now what you've written, and now we want to get to know the next layer of you. And so your application is reread and read and read over and over again. So every applicant can know that they have been heard when we get their application.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You're now reminding me of the fact that you guys do these interviews that are based on the application and not, you know, just sort of what we call a blind interview would be like resume based. Like, this is someone who sat with your file, really knows what you had to say, and can have a more in-depth conversation with you, which sounds like a great opportunity to me. I did want to ask you, you're in the amazing position of having applied to HBS probably in 2001, I guess, right? So,
yeah.
So because you graduated in 2004. So,
yep.
So how has your thinking about admissions changed over the years? Because a lot has happened in the couple of decades, right? So has anything changed in your mind about how this process works?
I think back in 2001, it was a human process where, you know, multiple people read your application. And I think we change essay questions, we change short answer questions on a regular basis. But I think the essence of what admissions is really trying to get to know the true person, and then trying to look at all these people who are applying and build a class that's going to learn from each other, teach each other, especially in our case-based method that we have at HBS, and be successful. And we want people that will thrive in this environment. There was one point where I had talked to the woman who had admitted me, and she's still here at HBS working in a different role. And I just asked her, I said, you know, how, when you're, and this was my first few weeks on the job, when you're looking at all these files, there's so many incredible people that are applying to HBS, and you feel bad when not all of them can get in. Mm-hmm. And she said, you always have to remember that there's people who are qualified, right? There's a lot of people that are qualified to come to all of our schools, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's selection. Like, how do you craft the class that's going to benefit from each other, that's going to thrive in this type of environment, and that's going to help each other succeed? And so that always gave me comfort that there are a lot of qualified people, because we get a ton of qualified people in our applicant pool, and we can't take everyone. But it's really about how do we make sure we're crafting the class that's going to benefit from each other.
And, you know, you're reminding me also of another kind of unique element of HBS is obviously the use of the case method. And so you're crafting a class often of, what is it, 900 people roughly, or,
yeah,
or somewhere in that ballpark?
A little over 900, yep.
Yeah. And so, but then that class obviously gets divided up into sections, right? And those sections, it's like each section has to be kind of a microcosm of the group, right? Because you want to have those interesting discussions. But I presume that they don't make you do that part. You bring in the 900 and then you pass it on to the program office and they get to shape. But I mean, obviously they're totally relying on you to give them what they need to build those sections, right?
Right. Yeah. And I would say, so each section has to be, you know, a subset of these different industries, these different geographies that people are coming from, different experiences that people have had, right? And we tried to craft, the program office just tried to craft it in you know, 90 people. And if you were to look at it on the surface, you'd be like, oh, they're very similar sections of 90 people.
Mm-hmm.
But each are drastically different because we're all human, right?
Right, of course.
But yeah, so we want to make sure all those voices are in the classroom so they can learn from one another. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems critical. What is something that applicants tend to worry about far more than they should? And I know earlier you mentioned that everything has to be perfect, but anything else come to mind with this question? Like, is there something you think candidates worry about way too much?
Yeah, I think getting the perfect essay, a lot of candidates worry about getting the perfect essay, right? Or getting the perfect GMAT score.
Mm-hmm.
And like I mentioned before, I think we are looking at you as, we're looking at you as pieces of the puzzle that we're trying to put together to get to know you. And so if there's any advice I would give an applicant is that look at the whole application, right? Look at the whole application and what's going to tell the story of you to us in the best possible way that's authentically you, just so we can get to know you, right? And so, and that's, I think if applicants look at it as pieces of the puzzle rather than I have to get each thing perfect, this essay has to be, you know, I should spend hours and hours and hours on it and make sure I proof it over and over and over again. I would much rather have someone that has a few typos in their essay rather than someone I can't even tell who they are because they've edited their personality out of the essay.
Yeah, that's great advice. So now looking at students that you've admitted over the years, and, you know, I'm guessing that now that you've been in the role for a few years, you've seen some students obviously go through the program. What are some of the qualities that you think distinguishes a student who really makes the most of the opportunities available during the MBA? So not what are the qualities that, you know, get someone into HBS, but what are the qualities that allows that person to really get the most out of the experience there?
Yeah. If I had to pick two things, I think it would be this hunger just to learn, right? This hunger and desire to learn and curiosity. So you mentioned our case-based method. And our case-based method is you read a case prior to class. You come to the classroom ready to discuss. You have your opinion on what, and the case is really about what should this protagonist or what should this leader of a company or an organization or a country do based on this limited information that you have. And you come to the class with a perspective. I think that the magic in the classroom happens when you have this hunger to learn and this curiosity. Like, you are really interested in what people that have lived in that geography that this company is based in have to say. You are really interested in what people who've worked in these types of functions have to say. You are really interested in people who've worked in these industries have to say. And they are adding to your arsenal of information that is leading to you having just stronger judgment overall. And so I think if you think about the classroom, I think this idea of this innate hunger for information, for this desire to learn, and this curiosity are essential to get the most out of the classroom. I also think those two traits are just in order to get the most out of the community are very valuable, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a curiosity to learn different types of, you want to engage in clubs that you might not engage in or you might have never had exposure to. You want to meet people from different backgrounds that you might not naturally have been connected to in the past. Like this just builds to their arsenal of knowledge and the ability to take all these insights and take all this information and be able to just make judgments on multiple things in the world. And so I think those two traits, both from a community perspective to get the most out of the HBS community, as well as out of the classroom, are super important.
I'm really glad to hear you say that, just because sometimes I feel like maybe in the press a bit, and also just, you know, when you just read what people say online, there's this idea that I'm going to business school to get a job, after business school.
Mm-hmm.
But really, you're spending 2 years doing something, which is learning.
Yeah.
and that is like so important. And I think especially when I think about how you all operate with the case method, I can't imagine someone not coming prepared to discuss in class because, I mean, I presume you guys still do cold calling and things. So you have to come into class ready to be able to talk about the case.
Right.
So I just feel like, yeah, that makes a ton of sense that people really need to be curious and you know, kind of have that hunger to learn. That's what sort of makes the experience. But I just wish more people would talk about that because it's it's really such a great aspect of getting an MBA. Speaking of all of that, when alumni come back to campus or when you run into them on the road, what is something that they often tell you that they didn't fully appreciate when they were students, but now kind of in hindsight are really appreciative for?
Yeah. So I think they appreciated the section experience, but they didn't appreciate what the section experience was giving them from a learning perspective as much as they could have, right? So if you think about the section experience and you think about we have people from all the different industries, all the different geographies, all different life experiences in this classroom. And when they craft the classroom, and this is not me, but this is the program office, when they're crafting all the way down to the people that you sit next to. And so they're really trying to get every individual exposure to people that they wouldn't necessarily have exposure to in their everyday life, right? If you were to join a club, you're joining a club of like-minded people, right? If you're joining, making a friend circle, you're meeting people at the gym because you all like the gym together, right? And so like the places that you're meeting people are people who have similar interests to you. Mm-hmm. The section gives you this experience of so many variables, so many different interests, so many different perspectives, and they miss having that, right? They miss having that in their day-to-day life because as we get back into our day-to-day life, you're starting to surround yourself by people who are somewhat similar to you, right? And working in the same industry as you or working in the same functions as you. And they loved the learning that they got from people who are outside of their comfort zone in a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one thing that we always hear from alumni when they come back to campus is they really do miss having all these different voices and perspectives on a daily basis. And I think a lot of our alumni still keep some of it because they have their WhatsApp groups where they'll throw out questions and they'll try to get answers, but it's not the same as living it every day for 2 years. And I would say the other piece that people say that they really do miss is just how accessible our faculty is. And I think a lot of people come into HBS maybe from their undergrad experience where the professor was the teacher and then you were the students. And there was kind of like this, not hierarchy, but there was like the professor was the professor and you were the students, right? And I would say HBS is very... because the professor is orchestrating the classroom, right, in the case-based method, they're not teaching a lecture most of the time, right? They're really about trying to make sure that they're getting all the voices heard. They're so accessible to the students, right? And so as you're having some of these conversations, you're going up to your professor after and saying, hey, I have this business idea. Can we talk about this business idea? And can you help me try to figure out what I should do next? And so I would say a lot of our students start forming these relationships with faculty. What some of them say is they see a lot of their peers form these beautiful relationships with faculty that they're still calling on faculty and they wish they had done more of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that, and honestly, if I had to go back to my 20 years, I wish I had formed stronger relationships with faculty that were still, and now I get a second chance at that, which is great. But I wish I had done that back then and had that guidance throughout my career, because I mm-hmm. think it would have been invaluable as I was thinking through next steps and what I want to do and roles I should be taking.
So I have to ask you, so because you're a grad of the program and you just talked about the value of the section, I just would love to know, like, are you still in touch with classmates and what does that look like exactly? I mean, some of it could be, I guess, social, but how are you connected to either your section mates or just classmates in general?
Yeah, I'd say just the alumni network in general will always answer a call from an alum.
Mm.
And so a lot of my jobs throughout my career have come from HBS alums, either directly or indirectly through HBS alums who have connected me to people.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that my section is near and dear to my heart. And I have a few of my section mates that we still travel at least once a year together.
Oh, wow.
If not twice a year together, just to make sure we all spend time together. And they're some of my best friends. And so that bond holds true 20 years from now. In fact, I just texted one of my section mates yesterday and I was telling her that my husband and everyone is out, my children are out of town. Let's go out for dinner and let's just have like us time on Sunday. And so you tend to form your groups within your section that you will maintain relationships with. But by entire section, when we get together for reunions, when I'm on the road, I was in South Africa a couple years ago, and one of my section mates invited us over for dinner, and I got to meet his kids, who weren't existent when we were all in business school together, right?
Right.
And so it was just, it's this wonderful network that you always can call on and that will always be helpful. But then there'll also be the people that you turn to just for advice and thoughts, and they'll do the same to you.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you're touching on all these things, whether it's the education or the kind of connections that you forge, because they're harder to measure. You know, sometimes people really oversimplify with a kind of, oh, you spent this much for the degree. What was your first salary out of, you know, and that stuff just really fades into the rear view, I think, as you kind of get out into the workforce and move on from job one to 4, 10, you know, wherever you're headed. You know, there's just such a rich, you know, kind of experience and network to tap into. All right. So with all the niceties aside, I have to ask you, what is a stereotype about HBS that you would love to debunk?
Yeah, I'd say the class of 900 is way too many, that you can't form these intimate relationships. It feels too big. It feels too cold. I'd say that is absolutely untrue. I think what HBS, you get kind of, you get the value of this enormous group of people, 900 plus people, that you can find people who have similar interests to you. You can form clubs, you can join clubs, you can create clubs, you can do whatever you want with people who have similar interests. But then you have your section of 90. And it was funny, I was just on the road in Asia a couple weeks ago, and someone had, and I love the way that one of our alumni framed it. They said, your section is your family. You're kind of stuck with them. They're the ones that they have formed, and you, these are the people that you have to, you know, you have to get to know, right? And we, and HBS puts you in a section of 90, and this becomes your family. And they're like, but it actually is really like family. You end up loving these people. They're potentially, there's going to be a few that are probably naturally that you would be friends with, you know, outside, but there's going to be a lot that maybe you would have not had exposure to. And you learn to love each other, and you learn to really get to know each other. And these are the people that you live your whole first year with, right? And so you get that intimate group of 90 people that you get to know on a much deeper level. And then you have access to this class of 900, where you can find people with similar interests, or people who might have been in a role that you're interested in going into that you can have a coffee chat with. And it's just, you have this network of people that you have exposure to. So it is a big school, but it feels very small, and it feels very personal, and it feels very intimate.
Yeah, I love that you're making this point, just because I think it's often lost on people that people just look at what's the size of the class, right? When they're looking at different business schools. What they don't know is that almost all the business schools will take whatever size class they have and put it into groups that are often the size of like a section at HBS anyway, right? So
exactly.
You know, you could, it's not like if you're going to a small school, you're in a classroom, a section that has 12 people in it. You're still in a classroom that has a bunch of people in it. So it's not, so I'm glad that you're underlining that, because I think sometimes people don't do their homework there. Last question for you in terms of our like serious questions for today, and that is, what role does Boston or the greater region and the local community even play in the student experience at Harvard Business School?
Yeah, I would say Boston is just an extension of the HBS classroom and also the HBS community. So when we think about from a classroom perspective, Boston is just a global hub for education, healthcare, science, entrepreneurship, innovation. Our students work with different startups, different nonprofits in the area in order to apply a lot of the learnings that they have in the classroom to these organizations in the community as well. And then if we think about from a community perspective, Boston is just like an ecosystem of colleges and universities, and it just creates this very vibrant community. Our students love having access to being able to go skiing on the weekends, because we have Vermont and New Hampshire right above us. If you're indoor people or outdoor people, there's always something for you. So outdoor folks, there's tons of hiking, tons of things that you can do outdoors. From an indoor perspective, if you like museums, we have a huge ecosystem of museums and cultural programs within the Boston community. And then we just have access to everything on the East Coast, right? So the East Coast, there's tons to do, tons to see, and our students just love to be at this center hub of all that's happening on the East Coast.
Yeah, and I can totally attest to that, because you may recall I was on campus not too long ago, and you know, a run along the Charles River, or there's an amazing museum on your campus. I mean, there's just all kinds of great things to take advantage of, whether you're indoors or out, as you say.
Yeah.
And also HBS seems really active in the community too. I mean, it sounds like even in the name of the suburb that are, you know, I don't know if it's technically a separate city, Alston, right, where the campus is located,
yep.
You're doing things in that community as well, right?
For sure. And HBS is dedicated to making sure that this community thrives. So they're building different ecosystems, entrepreneurship ecosystems on within Alston, mm-hmm. bringing restaurants, bringing just trying to make it just more dynamic for the community.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last thing I want to do is I have these lightning round questions. And the goal of these is, you know, candidates listening are like, oh, you know, she's the director and I'm afraid, you know, that she's a gatekeeper, right? And we want to make sure that candidates know that you're also just a regular human being and that you're, as you said earlier, you know, you're just trying to get to know all these candidates and you're not a gatekeeper. You're, you know, trying to find out what everyone has to offer and how to bring people into the community. So by answering these questions, hopefully they'll get to know you a little bit. So we'll just go kind of rapid fire. The first one is simple. It's just coffee or tea?
Tea. Tea through and through. And if I'm drinking coffee on a certain day, you know that it's been a rough day.
Excellent. All right. Beach or mountains?
Definitely a beach. I'm more of a relaxed by the beach. Relaxed on the beach with a book.
Okay. Are you a morning person or a night owl?
I'm more of a midday kind of gal. I'm not an early riser, nor am I someone that can stay up late at night. I think my peak is midday.
Okay. Excellent. What about a pet peeve that you have?
I think people who just don't say what they actually mean. So just like passive aggressive, just be authentic. Tell people what you're really after, and people are willing to help and people are willing to do things to help, right? And so just be really upfront.
Okay. What about a comfort food?
So I'm torn. I would say I'd say Italian food is definitely a comfort food, but Thai food too. I know it sounds very strange to have both of those as my comfort foods, but I will turn to either of those.
Well, I mean, spaghetti, pad thai,
there's
some connections
there. There's some similarities,
there.
Yes. Thank you. Thanks for trying to make that connection.
What about a guilty pleasure?
So I love arts and crafts. And so me with my girls have built a huge craft room down in our family room. And it is exploding with arts and crafts to the point where my husband's like, you cannot buy any more. But I would say I love doing arts and crafts. It is that is where you will find me and my children whenever we have free time or time away.
Oh, that's terrific. What is the best advice you've ever received?
Say it was from my dad. My dad, when I was I would say right around when I was graduating business school, I think he had secretly hoped that I would go into finance. And then he realized that's never going to happen. And so his advice to me was do what you love. Money will follow. Everything else will follow. But as long as you're doing what you're passionate about and what you love, everything else will fall into place. And so far it's held true, right? Like I'm doing what I love and I'm able to do what I love.
Yeah. And it's funny that just because I'm thinking about the evolution of your parents from, you know, you going off to either engineering school or medical school but they must have been happy when you went to HBS. And it sounds like, yeah, that's terrific. It's really nice to hear that as a bookend to the show. The last question I have for you actually, though, is what is the best thing that you've read, watched, or listened to recently?
So we have a professor, Leslie John, and she has this book, Revealing, which I recommend everyone read or listen to some of her podcasts as well. But it's all about the art of over and under sharing. And should you overshare or should you undershare? Where should you fall in the balance? And what are kind of the risks of undersharing?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the risks of oversharing, and how should you bridge that balance? And it's just, it's so interesting. And it's, I would highly recommend just looking, trying to get access to some of her content.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I'm going to note that. I love doing this show just because I get all these recommendations of things to read or listen to, et cetera. Rupal, thank you so much for joining us. This has been incredibly helpful. I know that everyone tuned in has learned a lot about HBS and a little bit about you as well. And just, yeah, appreciate you making time today.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was fun.
All right. So that's going to do it for this episode of the show. Thanks for tuning in to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions podcast. And please remember to subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you listen. We'll be back with more of these admissions Q&As all summer long, as well as our regular weekly episodes airing on Mondays.